20 days, one historic move, an unbelievable journey. Melania from the Amazon MGM Studios captures the one-of-a-kind transition into the White House, showcasing the planning, the pressure, and personal moments that come with stepping into the role of the First Lady for a second time. From logistical complexities to decisions made behind closed doors, the film brings you closer to Mrs. Trump and her family as they return to the nation's capital. See what history looks like before the doors officially open. Melania arrives exclusively in theaters January 30th, 2026.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's a busy, busy day. Can you believe it? We have a lot going on as the president is getting set to go overseas and consult with our allies who might just be enemies. This hour, I'm going to be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Alan West about things on the border, how much better they are. Also, the exodus from New York to Dallas. I was able to talk to the Dallas mayor on Sunday on One Nation, and he basically said, we're open season for people looking to relocate. And after all, we have a mayor in New York City that said, I don't think billionaires should be allowed. And he's raising the rates for corporate America to match New Jersey's, which are the highest in the country. Let's get to the big three.
Number three. Less work with Denmark. The groups that benefit most from this break with NATO is Vladimir Putin. If we want to go against Russia, let's put some more assets in supporting the Ukrainians.
That is Senator Mark Warner. Greenland's future on the forefront of President Trump's mind, and Europe's convenes with our commander-in-chief as he heads over to Davos. They are very upset. Does he want to do a deal, or does he just want Greenland or bust?
Number two.
We're here to worship Jesus. Yes. That's why we're here. Yeah. Okay. That's why we're here. Okay. That's what we're about.
Don't you think Jesus would be understanding
love
these folks?
We're about spreading the love of Jesus.
Really? Don Lemon? He's going to tell us what Jesus would do? Raiding a church, taking over a Target shopping center? Are these examples of peaceful protests? That's the question all anti-ICE activists have to ask themselves. As DHS announced, 10,000 illegal immigrant criminals have been taken off the Minneapolis streets, 3,000 over the last 6 weeks, as clashes continue.
Number one.
Tomorrow is the first year. Think of it, 1 year. I don't think there's been a term like it. I don't think any president has had a better first year than we've had. But I inherited a mess, and now we have the hottest country anywhere in the world.
President of the United States selling his first year in the second term. Here we go. What has Trump accomplished? And what do you hope he has left to do and hope he accomplishes this year? So we'll look at that. Now, what has he accomplished? A lot. I mean, at the very least, if you're sitting at home, go, I don't like Donald Trump, you can't say he doesn't do a lot. You can't say he doesn't do multiple things at once. Whether you like the executive orders, whether you like the passage of the Big Beautiful Bill, you like the action with Venezuela, take a look at it. 8 straight months of zero catch and releases at the border. He sealed the border. Nobody thought that was possible. 1.9 million illegal immigrants took the deal, either left on their own or took the $10,000 to relocate and come back the right way. Love it. About 600,000 tossed out of the country, being captured and scooped up by Border Patrol or ICE or the combination of both. Reciprocal tariff garners, $297 billion into our coffers. Now, I believe our deficit's going to be like $650 billion, which is a lot, but it was at $1.4 trillion. So it's coming down, and right now that tariff money goes against the deficit. Doge cuts around $215 billion. That's pretty significant. Gas falls to its lowest level in 4 years and going down. Operation Midnight Hammer was awesome, blowing up the Iranian nuclear program, obliterating it for now. They still have the technology, but man, what a mission that was. And the best military recruitment in 15 years. Then you have Operation Resolute extracts Maduro from his bed along with his wife and puts him in a Brooklyn jail. And now he got a chance of kicking Russia and China right out of that country. So year one, pretty good. President said this January 8th about what he thinks his biggest accomplishment was. Cut to.
Closed. You can't come in. Nobody comes. Nobody even tries. And the people in Texas, Arizona, all these places that I won by such big numbers, they are so happy with the border. They had homes that they weren't even able to live in their home. Every day people were knocking on their door, every hour. And it's just a great honor to be involved with it. The ICE and Border Patrol and all of the people have been so good. Tom Holm and Christy Noem. The people have done such an incredible job. You have no idea.
So they asked in a poll, how are things better now than when Trump took office? So for themselves and their family, in 2024, they said things have 40% approve of the way things were in this country for them and their family. In 2025, they're up 5 points to 45%. 2023, the number was 39%. In 2019, with President Trump prior to the pandemic, it was at 47%. So this question was asked by Fox News pollsters. Voters who say 2025 was a good year for the country, 35% say now, right now, they say 35%. In 2024, they thought that was only 28% thought it was a good year. 2023, 24%. 22 is 23%. 21, 19%. And in 2020, only 13% of the country thought things were good for them. So look, in this environment, Republicans and Democrats are not going to get over 50%, maybe 53%. Because we're just too polarized. There's some people, Republicans will never compliment a Democratic president, and there's, or when a Democratic president's in control. And some Republican Democrats will never say anything positive if a Republican's in control. Having said, that's why I think that if you have 45% approval rating, that's a lot better than I would have said during the Bush or Clinton years. So the president's approval rating right now is 44%. And I want to know what you would give him. 1-866-408-7669. Crime and safety, 47% approve. But when it comes to immigration, 45% approve. Why? Because I think some people think it's controversial to go into these cities and have to pull people out. 42% say they like his foreign policy, which blows me away. It's by far the best foreign policy ever. Greenland's a little rocky, I get it, but he's bolstered NATO, Venezuela, Iran. You see what happens with the Gaza peace plan, the reinvigoration possibly of the Abraham Accords. Come on. How could you not be giving him 55% approval on foreign policy? 39% approval on the economy. That's got to come up. Government spending, tariffs at 38% approval rating. So what are you looking for him to do in the second term? Well, first off, first and foremost, the big story now is Greenland. Why? Because the president says he's taking it. And most Republicans don't even want him to take it by force. Most people don't want to spend the $900 billion, including me, to buy it. To me, there's a deal to be done here. And the deal is really simple. We go in for the rare earth extraction as well as refinery. We take 2/3 of all of it for us, 1/3 for them, because we're the only ones who can do it, meaning them, meaning Denmark and Greenland. And then we agree with NATO to build 5 more bases on Greenland and begin to install the Golden Dome and maybe get some buy-in from NATO on that. To me, that's an overall win, I think. So that's personally. Here's Peggy Noonan on the first year, cut 6.
Some things are the same. What Donald Trump believed in 2016 is more or less what he believes in now. That's kind of consistent. His themes are his themes. I think he is more confident. I think he has grown hardened, and I think those around him have grown hardened. I also think the first term he really tested boundaries. I think in the second term, he's not in the mood to see boundaries. So, and he continues to love chaos. He does very well in it. That suggests to me there will be more chaos.
So, I happen to know somebody who spoke to the president yesterday and said that, you know, he's coming around to some type of deal on Greenland. But then he found out this information. Now, stay with me on this. Shockingly, our brilliant NATO ally, this is sarcasm, the United Kingdom is currently planning to give away the island of Diego Garcia, the site of a vital U.S. military base in Mauritius, and to do it for no reason whatsoever. There's no doubt that China and Russia have noticed this active weakness. By the way, they are allies with China and Russia. These are international powers who only recognize strength, which is why the United States of America, under my leadership, is now, after only 1 year, respected like never before. The UK giving away, the UK giving away extremely important land is an act of, in caps, great stupidity, and is another in a very long line of national security reasons why Greenland has to be acquired. Denmark and its allies have to do the right thing. Thank you for your attention. So the Speaker of the House gave a historic speech in the House of Commons a few hours ago over in England, at which time they cited about how far we've come in our relationships and our 250th birthday. But they had to deal with a lot of upset allies who want to go to bat for Denmark, not for us. As the president said 500 years ago, somebody lands there in a ship and says it's theirs. That doesn't hold up today. I'm going to take a time out and come back for Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. I want to talk about Minneapolis with him, also our options in Iran and so much more. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
A talk show that's real. This is The Brian Kilmeade Show.
There is a certain degree of racism there, and there's a certain degree of entitlement. I think people who are, you know, in the religious groups like that, it's not the type of Christianity that I practice, but I think that they're entitled, and that entitlement comes from a supremacy, a white supremacy.
So that is Don Lemon walks into a church and decides they're white supremacist. Are you nuts? Minneapolis, mostly white city. By the way, most of the protesters outside are white. Look at them. Just take a look. And are they white supremacists going out there to go against ICE? Why does this guy have to bring race into everything? Race has nothing to do with it. Because you're in a Protestant church practicing white supremacy? What an idiot. And I've always thought he was an idiot. Now I'm convinced of it, and there's no coming back. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West joins me now, Dallas County Republican Party Chair, American Constitutional Rights Union Executive Director. Colonel, your thoughts about storming the church because you don't like ICE, and evidently you didn't like a pastor, but who, by the way, wasn't there at the time.
Well, no, it's good to be with you, Brian. First and foremost, for Don Lemon, I would say he needs to read Proverbs 17:28, and I paraphrase, it's better for a fool to keep his mouth shut than to open his mouth and confirm the fact. Look, I don't understand how the left believes that they can just walk into a church and violate the First Amendment, the freedom of religion and the free exercise thereof, and start shouting down pastors and ministers. This is really getting out of control, and I think that what the left is doing is they're showing that this whole derangement syndrome thing, this delusion, it is for real. And in this year, this supposedly a huge midterm election year, all they're doing is creating commercial advertisements to be run against them come September and October to remind people of how out of control they are and why we should not allow them. Think about the words that Ilhan Omar said to describe the United States of America at this Democratic hearing they had up in Minneapolis. These are not the people we want to have in leadership positions in our legislative
branch. What did she say, Colonel? I missed that.
She said the United GD States.
Really? She's a nonstop complainer. She hates the country that basically saved her life, that she may have lied her way into. So, and now she became a congressman representing one of the most corrupt areas of one of the most corrupt cities in America, where billions are missing. And by the way, the restaurant that she had her victory party in was the restaurant that was making up false claims that Feeding America was actually building their mansions, Porsches, and maybe financing terror. But listen to how this sounded in church. Cut 11.
Yeah.
You are a fake Christian. Why are you not standing with your Somali and Latino communities? Why do I not see you out at Whipple every day protesting this attack on humanity? Living real comfortable while the people starve. Living real comfortable while children are dragged into concentration camps.
What? What do I say to that?
Yeah.
What do you say to this?
Well, what you say to that is, first of all, this is a person that is unhinged. The next thing you say to that is, again, I'm going to go back to the Bible. When the Pharisees came up to Jesus and they asked him about, you know, paying taxes, and he said, whose image is on the coin? He said, you render unto Caesar what is Caesar. Look, the government is supposed to protect our borders and boundaries and our sovereignty. These people that they are obviously out there protesting about are in this country illegally. That's a federal offense. I think it's Title 18, United States Code 1325. Why are you going in churches and shouting down, wanting to protect people that are here illegally? And then on top of that, people that are here illegally committing crimes, you know, thou shalt not kill. I think that's one of the Ten Commandments. And I mean, some of the other things, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods. I mean, they're out there assaulting people and burglaries and things of this nature. So the left is really finding themselves completely on the wrong side of this issue, and they did not get the memo from November 2024.
So yeah, this is amazing too, but I wonder, because 51% of the country in a survey by, I think it was CNN or CBS, said that they think ICE is being too tough. But were they too tough when they took 10,000 criminals off the illegal immigrant criminals off the street and 3,000 in the last six months? And they have the bios. If you don't believe the numbers, look at the bios. And these aren't all Hispanic. This is from Laos and in Thailand. This is everywhere. They go to Minneapolis because you can run wild. But yet the mayor says this is about love. A neighbor going to shop for another neighbor because they're afraid to go shopping because they'll be scooped up and brought into prison. Why would they get scooped up, Colonel West? Maybe because they're here illegally?
Yes. Well, that's the whole thing. Let's start off. Why is ICE out there in Minneapolis? Because unconstitutionally and unlawfully, they have declared themselves a sanctuary city for people that have broken the law and people that continue to, you know, have offenses in breaking the law. So those people are not allowed. They're not entitled, to use their word. They're not entitled to be here in the United States of America wrongfully. And then on top of that, when you look and see, you know, the people that are out there obstructing their operations, that's also against the law. So you just see a series of ICE trying to go out and do and rectify a situation of lawlessness, but these people are rioting in the streets because they want lawlessness. They want criminals. These are not just our neighbors. This is not just the Maryland man. These are people that are here committing crimes.
No doubt about it. And the attorney general, who's a really a corrupt individual, Keith Ellison, cut 15.
Yes.
Here's what frustrates me. Over 3,000 ICE agents escalating into our state, a threatened 1,500 active duty military soldiers. That's what frustrates me. This situation is 100% because of Operation Metro Surge. This escalation, unjustified, irrational, inconstitutional, is why this is happening. I urge all people to obey the law, to try to do everything they can to not be provoked. But the reality, he's trying to provoke us.
They're in the face of ICE agents. They're trying to disturb where they sleep, prevent them from going to the bathroom, stopping them from going down their blocks. And they think that these people are doing it peacefully and admirably. Are you crazy? They're getting paid. People are financing this. They're formatting the whole thing in New York. They're getting ready to do the same thing in New York shortly.
Yeah. Now, this is the Attorney General of Minneapolis, and I mean Minnesota, and I served in Congress with him. He's supposed to be the top law enforcement officer in the state of Minnesota. But yet, there's a letter that Keith Ellison has sent out to sheriffs in the state of Minnesota that are cooperating and working with ICE, and he's threatening them. So why is it that the Attorney General is threatening law enforcement, constitutionally duly elected law enforcement officers, sheriffs, to not do what is right by abiding by the law? And furthermore, ICE would not be there in Minneapolis if the Minneapolis police, when they picked up these individuals, they kept them in the jails and they turned them over to ICE there.
Thanks so much, Colonel West. Appreciate it. When we come back, Lieutenant Colonel Scott West. Scott, man, don't move. Listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
No, I am expecting military action for sure.
Okay.
And then there's no doubt about it. I mean, we're bringing these resources to bear, and it's likely because we had to expand the target set. And why are we expanding it? Because we had to consider what is Iran going to do in retaliation? Our bases are vulnerable. Mm. What are they going to do about Israel? Are they going to attack Israel? Likely. Mm. And they're vulnerable. And what are we going to do about their ballistic missiles? Are we going to take them down before they fire them at our bases and also at Israel? Likely. Are we going to kill leaders? Certainly. Our IRGC members, the people that are oppressing the people? Absolutely.
I mean, they've already killed between 12, 25, some people say 100,000 people in cold blood. Can you imagine having protesters in the street and just gunning them down, going up to them and shooting them in the back of the head, piling up their bodies, then charging their families for every bullet they needed to kill your kid or to kill your loved one in order to get him back? Or they want to pile them up so high or make the price so high to get the body back that you can't afford it, so they don't count it. So the world says, and then yet Ayatollah Khomeini come out and say it was Donald Trump that had his people assassinate the Iranians in the streets. Does any clear-thinking person believe that? With me right now is Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann. No one has to introduce him to the Middle East. He's got war experience. He's also conducted and coordinated Task Force Pineapple when Joe Biden dropped the ball and left everybody in Afghanistan and left with our military. He had to go in and get everybody out. And the author of Nobody is Coming to Save You, A Green Beret's Guide. And by the way, he's got a brand new play. It's 11 Days. Which is coming to New York City. The performance date is already sold out. The opener on the 21st. The next one, the 22nd and 23rd. You can still get tickets. It's at 7 p.m. On the 24th at 1 and 7. And not only do you write it, but you star in it, right, Scott?
Yeah, I do 24 characters in 90 minutes.
Wow.
And it's based on Pineapple Express, the 11 days that led up to Abbey Gate.
Wow. So you have a theater show, a one-man show. Do you have theoretical background?
No, I did not start acting until I was 50. It's like the ultimate midlife crisis, man. But right. when I wrote Last Out, I wanted people to understand the cost of modern war. So I wrote the play Last Out. And I just fell in love with it. I mean, it really saved my life and helped me through, you know, what I tell people is kind of like what's going on with the film Sheepdog to address, you know, PTS on the screen. This is my approach to doing the same thing in live theater, but it really helps a lot.
All right, great. I want to get back to that, but first on Iran, what General Jack Keane said.
Yeah.
So you see the 2009, we did nothing because they wanted to do a nuclear deal. 2019, cursory, and then 2022, totally ignored it. So now the people going into the streets in every single province. There's no water in Tehran. The inflation's through the roof. People can't afford anything. Their rial is almost worthless. So these people rose up because they hate their lives. They hate their government. What do you see our role?
Well, I mean, this is a major decision point, Brian. I think that, you know, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, Iran in its current state has only been here really since, you know, the mid to late 70s. I mean, like, it hasn't always been this way. Right. Yeah. And, you know, the same with Afghanistan. I mean, so what you're talking about is a strategically bad actor who has their fingers into everything, man. But the people of that country, they are right on the precipice of overthrowing this regime. And what does Iran do every time? They export the blame. That's what they're really good at, is they manufacture anger and fear to try to take it off of themselves. But this time, I don't know if they can pull it off.
I don't know. You know, right now, I guess the protests have stopped because they're just killing people in the street.
It's just brutal.
I guess for now, and they might permanently cut off the internet. Is that even possible today?
You know, I think they can. I think they can certainly suppress it to such a degree that you lose momentum. And you know, here's the thing about an insurgency or an uprising. Is they will last for a while, but ultimately, because it's easy to say, well, they should just handle it themselves. If you look throughout history, and I spent most of my life studying unconventional warfare as a Green Beret, you have to have an external actor. You know, when you're going to push an unconventional warfare or an insurgent movement
over guns
to topple a regime without arms, that's why the Afghan forces fell so quickly to the Taliban. There's no external force to help push it over the line. Even the United States Revolution. We had France that helped get it over the line against Great Britain, right? And without them, most historians will agree, we would not have been able to overthrow Britain. So What role we play in this will be extremely critical as to whether or not this uprising succeeds or fails.
Right. We should never put people on the ground. I don't think Trump wants to do that, but he wants to maybe weaken them to the point. I also think we could. Is there a way, a legal way to arm the population?
Well, there are certainly ways to arm populations, and the United States has actually, for many, many years, developed a process of unconventional warfare or irregular warfare where we work by, with, and through indigenous populations to stand up on their own. That's what Special Forces, the Green Berets, was designed to do. There are ways to do this that you can actually empower the populations of a country like Iran that are oppressed to rise up on their own and affect it indirectly. Whether or not we're doing that, I mean, I wouldn't comment on it even if I knew, but I think that those options are certainly on the table. What we get myopically focused on are the surgical strike type raids that you see in the movies, or like you saw when we pulled Maduro out, and those are awesome. But there are also other ways to facilitate an uprising by, with, and through that are not as apparent, but they're still very viable.
I hear we're doing cyber attacks already. The other thing they're going after is banks. They're trying to find out where these guys, evidently, when we went after the central bank years ago, they decided a lot of the rich people, the kleptocrats that run that country, started moving their money to the UAE and to Kuwait and other places.
Yeah.
Don't you think we're good at tracking that by now?
100%. After the 20-year war.
Can we just hold that money back?
Yeah, our counter-threat finance capabilities after the 20-year war and the global war on terror certainly are extremely good. And I have no doubt that this administration will bring various instruments of power basically to isolate Iran. But here's one other thing to think about, Brian, and this is something you and I have talked about, is we have to remember that Iran, you know, part of their way of navigating the world is they use asymmetric warfare. They put sleeper cells and bad actors in other places, to include here, to include the West. And so that's the thing. If these Ayatollahs and these mullahs feel like they're on their last leg and they're not coming out alive, one of the things we need to be thinking deeply about is homeland protection and how this could manifest right here at home with asymmetric terror attacks.
Yeah, I think so, too. And also, when you see what's happening in Gaza, it's the most likely scenario. The IDF has to go back in and kill Hamas because they're not going to voluntarily give up their arms like they're supposed to.
Of course they're not. They're not. I mean, that I just think
they have nowhere to go.
They don't. And their whole narrative is based on this. Like, that's the thing that I think we miss is that some of these organizations like the Taliban, like Hamas, like Hezbollah, like Al-Qaeda, you cannot negotiate with them because they're not rational actors. They base their operations on a multi-century narrative of a global caliphate that does not coexist with the West or any other religion. And that's just how it is. And to think that you can, like, if you cut deals with them, you have to understand that you're not cutting deals with a rational actor.
By the way, Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann is here, and he's got a brand new play out that debuts on the 21st. Today is the 20th, so it's tomorrow. And then the 22nd and 23rd at 7 p.m. The name of the location is The Wild Project at 195 East 3rd Street right here in New York City. So you have time to get here. Tickets start very affordable at $30. In New York, you're not going to get a better show than that. So, Colonel, you've been rehearsing for how long?
13 months. You know, it's Operation Pineapple Express. If you like that book, you need to come see me tell the story from the stage as I play these characters, everything from the 82nd Airborne guys that were on the ground at Abbey Gate to my friend Nizam and he and I, the phone calls we had, and even the Minister of Women's Affairs. People don't know this, but Pineapple Express extracted the Minister of Women's Affairs, Hasina Safi, the most wanted woman in Afghanistan, through a sewage canal and a 4-foot hole in the fence because the State Department wouldn't take her.
Is she here?
She's in England right now, but the story of how she got through that canal and an 82nd Airborne First Sergeant, she was terrified of soldiers because of the way the Russians beat her dad back in the day. And so she was so scared to get in that ditch. This big paratrooper from Georgia pulls her out, and the way she tells the story is that when she entered that filthy water, she had two brothers, and when she was pulled out, she had three. And to this day, they still stay in contact. They're like brother and sister.
Right.
And those are the kinds of stories that you'll find in this play. It's kind of like Argo meets Dunkirk.
Remind people how abandoned these things were. When we pulled out and we had that the last carrier leave, go to Qatar. Was it Qatar or UAE?
Yeah, right.
It was Qatar. How soon did Operation Pineapple move in? And well, form and move in.
We start. I mean, all of the volunteer groups really started mobilizing even before Afghanistan collapsed, because we saw it coming. Most of the volunteers were Green Berets and special operators, so we saw it coming. But it was really August 15th, 2021, when the collapse actually happened, that the phone calls started flooding our personal cell phones saying, hey, you know, this is so-and-so, commando buddy. I'm stuck and my family's on the run. Can you help us? And it just became, everybody thought they were doing it on their own, Brian. Nobody knew that they were like, that there were groups forming. It was very, very organic. But what came out of it were these amazing stories of friendships and courage. And they just didn't get told in the media. They certainly didn't get told by politicians. And that's what we want to do with this play, is that we want to tell the story of the friendships that built up over 20 years and what our veterans did when nobody else stepped up.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like it. How much do we leave behind? Billions of dollars worth of equipment. I mean, how crazy is that?
Billions.
We basically armed the Taliban.
And we left them 30,000 Afghan commandos. You know, like my friend Nizam, who was passenger number one on the Pineapple Express, not only was he an Afghan commando, Afghan special forces, he went to the U.S. Green Beret qualification course. He is a certified 18 Bravo weapon sergeant. He is certified to train, lead, and equip an indigenous battalion of operators.
Where is he?
He's here in the States now, you know, and a lot of guys like him got out, but a lot didn't. Mm-hmm. And that's the story we want to tell, because now it's going to be our children that end up going back into Afghanistan, into Iran, perhaps. Yeah. And what we've got to recognize,
because your son's in the Army.
He is. And when we build these relationships with these other countries, we have to recognize that how you leave, it's not about whether you should leave or not. It's how you leave. And if you just leave these people in a lurch that you trained for years with no recourse, then we're going to inherit something really ugly. And that's really what this play is about, is to tell that story.
Yeah, I know the last person to leave there was General Chris Donahue.
Yep.
Who's as respected as anybody in the Army.
Yep, we still stay in touch.
Yeah, and he's somebody that would be, I imagine, any type of these operations, I would hope, would be consulted. Especially, we have now a prison break in Syria where the ISIS families were being held. This happened yesterday. It's around the Kurdish area that we're looking out from, but Syria's looking to reclaim the rest of their country, and it looks like a prison break. This is 2 miles from our guys.
I'll say it on the record right now. It's really easy to get focused on Venezuela and Iran and the conventional fights right now, Greenland. But what I will tell people is ISIS and Al-Qaeda are not done. We will see another major terror attack on our soil sooner than later. And we need to make sure we don't take our eye off the ball, because these guys, just when they go quiet, that's when you need to really get concerned.
Right. I mean, I think I'm encouraged that when they did kill 2 of our guys and an interpreter, there was immediate retribution multiple times. It was a massive bombing, then follow-up bombings. It shows you there's intelligence on the ground. And perhaps the I don't know if you're buying into it. Is the Syrian government, you think, combining with us at this moment?
No, I don't believe that at all. I think they are bad actors. I think they just dress a little better than they used to.
That's it?
That's it.
Do you think the president was wrong to recognize him?
I do. I don't think he's someone we should be working with, but I don't think we should be working with the Taliban and giving them millions of dollars of cash every 10 days either.
That?
Absolutely.
The president was stopping that.
No, we're still giving money to the Taliban, and we're still using the Taliban as a counterterror partner.
I have no idea. How much are we giving? Do you know?
I'll get the numbers back to you, but it's tens of millions of dollars every 10 days or so.
In
cold, hard cash.
For what? People not starving to death?
Yeah, it's humanitarian aid, but it's also counterterrorism partnership, you know, for them to give us information on ISIS. But the reality is, I mean, my personal opinion is I think we're being played. I think the Taliban is still in bed with Al-Qaeda as much as they've ever been.
Wow.
They're not a responsible counterterrorism partner. And I think it's deluded to think that they
are. I never thought we were. But the Taliban, I would never do. My sense is, I know we send multiple American lawmakers over there to meet with the Syrian leader. And I think right now they don't seem to be a threat to Israel. I think that's an encouraging sign.
Yeah, I mean, again, I just think that you have to look at the character of these individuals.
Well, you have the resume. The resume is Al-Qaeda.
Absolutely. And I think that just because the dude cuts his hair and puts on a suit and tie does not change his character. And understand that they're operating off a multi-century narrative. They are patient. Mm-hmm. They're going to wait for the right moment, and they're going to play the game they need to play. But I just think that we get so distracted and we take our eye off the ball and we forget who we're really dealing with.
So I do love the fact that they push Russia out.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah, I think there's, you know, I think
there's... And keep Iran out.
Yep, I think there's good geopolitical things that come out of it. But what I fear is that we're dismissing the asymmetric terror capability that still exists in this world. Mm-hmm. And let's not forget, you know, this is the anniversary, the 25th anniversary of 9/11. And honestly, I think we have completely forgotten. I think we have forgotten the way this thing was orchestrated, the way it was conducted.
Well, put it this way, Scott. And by the way, we're talking with Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann. He's excited. He should be. His play is now coming out tomorrow. And also his best selling book. But the play is coming out tomorrow, and it's called 11 Days. So hopefully people go to, where can they go to order this?
Yeah, you just go to tfpineapple.org.
All right. Do you know this? Now there's people that said 9/11 is an inside job, and it's not just Rosie O'Donnell. Now you have people on the right who's saying, oh, yeah, this is an inside job. Of course we knew about it ahead of time. Of course George W. Bush looked the other way.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even.
Is that the most sickening thing you've ever?
It is extremely sick. I mean, I lost my Ranger buddy on 9/11 in the Pentagon, you know, and I think this is where an entire generation of warfighters from the global war on terror.
Well, do you hear what I'm saying?
I hear what you're saying, and I think it's disgusting. I think that it completely diminishes what an entire generation of warfighters and their families and our fallen gave to keep this country safe after 9/11. And if that's what we come away with, that it was an inside job, and that actually the work that went in to keep these guys at bay was not even legit, man, we're going to reap what we sow. That's all I can say.
All right, Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann, thanks so much for your service, and congratulations on yet another play.
Yes, sir.
I mean, people like to maybe star in a play. You're writing them, and you're starring in them.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann, thanks so much. Back in a moment.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
There's a lot more fear because we have the sense this existential dread is going to wipe everything out.
Right.
But that actually runs counter, in my view, to what history seems to show. What's going to be good at filling in all the places that are expensive and burdensome and then make it harder to do it. And it's always going to rely fundamentally on the human artistic aspects of it.
So that is Matt Damon, as well as Ben Affleck, talking about AI in movies. So I listened to The Daily yesterday, the New York Times podcast, and I'm not sure if this was a special or it was yesterday's, but they just talked about how AI is already being used. Now, some of it, I think Coke did a commercial, and it was panned because it was their word was soulless, total AI. But the other thing they're doing is, AI's putting in backgrounds and all types of awesome sets. It's costing almost nothing where it would have cost millions of dollars. Remember what James Woods told us on One Nation? We replayed it here, I think, where he says there's no doubt that AI will replace actors. You have to deal with agents. You have to deal with writers. You have to deal with temperaments.
Well, that's where, though, SAG is going to get involved with the unions. But what Ben Affleck was saying there, like AI getting involved in maybe creating the background, that can save a lot of money.
But it saves money. Okay, I'll do it. I have no money. But now I'm knocking extras out. There's no
more. But maybe
extras.
You just need like a pretty sky. Right? I don't know.
But where's the limit? I could save even more money.
Good question.
So Matt Damon and Ben Affleck talk about making movies, but that is the big thing in Hollywood. They are extremely nervous.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
1211 6th Avenue, Midtown Manhattan. Heard around the country, around the world. It's going to be a big hour. Don't ask me how I know. One of which is Governor Chris Sununu is here, and he doesn't realize it. But even though I'm standing, he can't stand because his mic doesn't go up. Unless you're going to hold the mic like Frank Sinatra.
Well, now that I'm out of office, I'm just going to put my feet up on the desk.
I know. It doesn't matter anymore.
It doesn't matter anyway.
And by the way, we got Steve Gratham and Matt Dallas coming in. Stars of the movie Sheepdog that's out. And you'll love it. It's definitely oriented towards our men and women that serve. Do a simulcast with Stuart Varney. So before we get to Governor Chris Sununu, who's now in the private sector, let's get to the big three.
Number three, less work with Denmark. The groups that benefit most from this break with NATO is Vladimir Putin if we want to go against Russia, let's put some more assets in supporting the Ukrainians.
All right, that is Senator Mark Warner, who suddenly realizes the border was bad during Joe Biden. He would never admit that, but now he does. Greenland's future on the forefront of President Trump's mind, and Europe convenes as our commander-in-chief heads to Davos, literally right now. I have a solution, and I'll share it.
Number two.
We're here. We're here to worship Jesus. Yes. That's why we're here. Yeah. Okay. That's why we're here. Okay. That's what we're about.
Don't you think Jesus would be understanding
it? We're about
and love these folks.
We're about spreading the love of Jesus.
Raiding a church, taking over a Target shopping center. Is there a peace? Is that peaceful protesting? Is that love like the mayor of Minneapolis claims? That's the question all anti-icers have to ask themselves. As DHS announced, 10,000 illegals have been taken off the Minnesota streets and 3,000 over the last 6 weeks. And the clashes continue. But how does this all end?
Number one.
Tomorrow is the first year. Think of it. 1 year. I don't think there's been a term like it. I don't think any president has had a better first year than we've had. But I inherited a mess, and now we have the hottest country anywhere in the world.
Year one of term two is in the books. What has Trump accomplished, and what do you hope he still has left to do? Chris, you're now Governor Chris Sununu.
So
always.
Much on tap today.
I know.
We could go on all day.
And you had to run for, it seems like you were there for 100 years because you had to run every two.
Every 2 years.
So every time I talk to you, you ran for re-election.
There you go.
And you kept winning, and you would have won again, and you would have probably been senator. But now your brother has been is trying to get the nomination. Scott Brown's also running, too. So a couple of things. How's he done year one?
The president? It's been an incredible – has any president had a first year like this? Right. And not just talking about the successes, but saying, look, I don't care what the status quo was. I don't care what the issue was, what other administrations weren't willing to take on. We're going after it, and we're going to go after it hard. So they've literally left no stone unturned. They've left everybody a bit with their jaws open in terms of what they're willing and trying to do in just the first year. Do I love every method and every message that comes out? No, but what the goals – in terms of prescription drugs, we forget about what he did there with the tax cuts, what he did there with energy, what the energy secretary and Doug Burgum are doing, opening up these reserves like never before.
We haven't really felt that yet. By the way, what they're doing behind the scenes, they are literally plowing the ground for a massive change.
We're feeling it with AI, though, right? Because AI is now making investments because AI's biggest cost is energy, knowing that the long-term energy of their facilities is secure, is allowing AI and all this technology to move forward faster here than anywhere else in the world. You can't do that unless you have the power. Otherwise, China would have been eating our lunch right now.
Help me with this. Data centers have to be built. But with it, you need energy for the data centers.
Huge.
I love what Trump said a few days ago. And he just said, look, if you're going to build a data center, you got to make the energy. You got to come up with the energy source.
That's right.
And then I asked Doug Burgum this directly, who's as honest as the day is long. And I said, Mr. Secretary or Governor, I just said, wait a second. Are you telling me the utility costs are going up in states with these data centers? Is there anything that can be done by it? He goes, that's not true. Well, clearly it's true because President Trump on Friday said, you got to pay for it because, for example, New Jersey and Louisiana is going to get slammed.
That's right.
Because they're building a huge facility for Meta.
Right. So there's a couple options there. One is you see some of them going in Texas. They're literally going right over where, like, the oil is, for example. Like, they're going to pull it out. They can literally refine it, turn it into electricity.
Build it.
The natural gas is right there. So they have to build it. But, again, cutting those transmission costs is huge. But if you're going to invest these hundreds of billions and trillions over the next 10 years in AI, they have to offset those costs. They are going to pull an energy demand like we've never seen before, which is okay if you're going to pay for it and not ask the rest of America to subsidize it for you.
Right. So we want to keep a lot of stuff here. Now, today's a big day because any moment we could be hearing about the tariffs, whether the president has the constitutional right to implement.
Can you imagine if they overturn it? Like, that's, I think, I talk to folks in the business. I work for the airlines now, and I talk to these folks in the business community all over the place. The tariffs are now baked in for the most part. If the Supreme Court were to overturn it, I would argue you're going to see as much chaos in the market as you saw when he first announced this on quote-unquote liberation back in April. Because folks have baked it in. It's assumed. It's there. But now to undo all that and reverse it, the uncertainty that would create in the financial markets across the world would be absolutely huge. Because what's going to happen is people go, well, does it apply to everything? Is Congress going to act? Can this somehow get undone? No one will know where it's going to end up. They're not just going to overturn it and it's going to sit there. There's other actions that could be taken that will take more time, will take longer. I think right now folks have said, look, we thought tariffs were going to rock the economy. I did. I was like, holy cow, I'm a free market guy. I said, boy, these tariffs are going to be really, really tough. This, we've all found a stabilization for the most part here. They're baked in to where where America wants to be in terms of balancing the budget. To undo it now would be really chaotic. Really chaotic.
And if you remember how John Roberts, Chief Justice, handled Obamacare, was he going to overturn it, right? And he knew, he wasn't just in a bubble, in a think tank. Right. He knew, what happens if I make this ruling constitutional or not? So he landed the plane, mm-hmm. right? He split the difference.
It and he lives, took a lot of heat survives. For doing that.
Yes.
And, took a lot of heat for doing it.
Right, because it would have blown up the whole healthcare system right. when it started.
There was no replacement.
So don't you think he's doing the same thing? It's the same guy. Don't you
possibly?
Think that's why it's later? Because yeah. he understands?
Possibly. And again, on this one, I'm not the macroeconomics guy. But you also have to be a lawyer here. Was he using those emergency provisions viable? You know, should he have used a different provision?
Is it an emergency?
Is it an emergency? Can he go back to Congress? What justifies an emergency? Can he have all these carve-outs that he's having? But, you know, I was on CNN this morning, and they were like, boy, the terrorists, you know, have created chaos. And I said, no, the EU tariff situation has found a nice balance. A lot of it has gone zero for zero. They've carved certain things out. Folks know they got to put
it's forcing
paper,
new trade deals with everyone.
Forcing new trade deals with everyone, allowing America to use leverage in ways we hadn't ever used before. Because you had a president to stand up and say, we're not just going to take it anymore. We're going to use our leverage. Some things will be in a positive, some things will be in a negative. But overall, we have much more leverage in terms of what's happening across the globe than ever before.
And by the way, Chris Sununu was the 82nd governor of New Hampshire. He's currently the president and CEO of Airlines for America. I'm sure you heard, I'll be flying out a little bit later. Do you have any advice for me?
Well, I'm waiting for you to fly. I think you should be doing this show live from Greenland. I think that would be the Brian Kilmeade move right there. That
would
be awesome.
I would love it.
That would be awesome.
But basically, after the show, I'd have nothing to do. I don't like to fish. So what if I go to, I'll live in a magenta house?
You plow roads. You can plow roads. There's lots of roads to be plowed. I'll teach you how to plow roads.
I'll get a shovel and look for lithium.
Wait, don't you have a place in Jacksonville? You're a Florida guy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we can't let you plow roads. Sorry.
Right.
You won't know what you're doing.
I'm really a Long Island guy. I mean.
No, I know, but you go down south.
Yeah, I'm Ponte Vedra area.
Yeah, yeah. That's nice.
Thank you.
Nice.
Thanks for your approval.
Well,
right?
Everyone else goes to like West Palm and like all down south there. It's so crowded down there. It's a little crazy. You're getting the best of both worlds. You don't have the traffic and the crowds.
I want to be accepted. And I want to stand out. If I go to Palm Beach, I won't get noticed. I'm all about being recognized. You know that, Governor. I'm a huge ego. For you in particular, how are you liking this job? And, of course, I just had Sean Duffy on the television show. He's accomplished so much.
Sean's doing an incredible job.
It's hard for me to remember who the transportation secretaries were. All I hear about
remember the guy right before Sean.
Yeah.
Pothole Pete, right?
And Normanetta was. Yeah. Was it Normanetta? Yeah.
Norm there? I don't even know.
I think so. It was the only one to go from a Democratic administration.
I remember way back in the day, LaHood was there. Oh, yeah. And Secretary Chow.
Yeah,
well, okay. she was wonderful. What Sean has done is said we're not going to run the Department of Transportation with bureaucrats and lawyers. We're going to bring people in and get stuff done. The FAA Administrator Brian Bedford. And the big thing for me is we've talked about it before, the air traffic control rebuild. It's the most complicated infrastructure project the government's ever taken on. $30 billion.
In real time.
Has to happen right now while we're landing tens of thousands of planes a day. So and there's a lot of issues there. It's basically a giant telecom system. So planes can talk to each other. The pilots can talk to the ground. The ground can make things more efficient. We're running things on floppy disks and paper strips. We've talked about that before. Sean and his team are saying no more. And the president, right? No president has taken this on for 40 years. The president's saying
it's costly.
We're going to get it. It's not only costly, but there's such high risk in not getting a big public works project done, right? So politicians tend to go, you guys handle that. And when it doesn't go well, I'm going to blame you, right? The president's saying we're getting this thing done because it's a national security.
You only
asset.
Have half the money right now. You got to get the money. $12 billion.
To all the senators and the congressmen, listen, we need that second round of funding.
Was Ted Cruz?
Because they're moving so fast, and Cruz gets it. I think Congressman Graves really gets it. Got to bring everybody else on board, but. I'm down in Washington reminding Capitol Hill, this president is moving so fast. His administration is moving so fast. Don't do business like you used to do it. Move quickly, get the money, and the new radar systems are coming. The copper is turning into fiber connections. They're rebuilding the facilities. They're putting new technology kind of behind the screen, as we say, so you can land more planes safer, have a better customer experience. It's going to be great, and thank God we have, again, an administration that gets how to do public work.
So we got a year until the midterm elections. And don't you love people, especially you are so into politics in the grandiose, not just New Hampshire. You always have the big picture in mind, maybe because of how you grew up.
Right? I guess so. It's in the blood a little bit. Yeah. You know, it's a New Hampshire thing more than anything.
Your brother was governor and senator.
Congressman and senator.
Congressman and senator.
Yeah, I was governor. My dad was governor.
Governor and chief of staff.
And White House chief of staff.
So you always have a great perspective, and you also go on CNN and get yelled at all the time, and you yell back. It's always fun.
Look, if I can handle The View a couple times, I can handle
Why would
anything.
You do that?
I mean, I love it.
Is
it the
old
best.
View?
I loved it.
Really?
Because to go on there and have them look at you and go, damn, we really like this guy. Because, we challenged each other. I didn't agree with them on much of anything.
Yeah, you have to be mean.
You know, they're demonizing Republicans all the time, and it's great to go on and where they have to admit to their own. Yeah, I guess all Republicans aren't evil, you know?
But everything you believe in is. So, when asked, which party in Congress do you trust more on the issues? Fox News did a poll yesterday. Democrats, 32%. Republicans, 38%. And by the way, you know Fox News polls do not go right
over. They're right down the middle, actually.
Yeah.
I'm actually surprised.
And by the way, everyone will tell you that.
Yeah.
Border security, 48-20.
Sure.
Obviously. Tariffs, 36-34 Republicans. Foreign policy, 38-33 Republicans. I can't believe it's
so
not
So what more. Do the Dems get? What issues do they get?
Don't give it away.
Okay.
I'm building.
All right.
Looking out for middle-class families, Democrats, 39%. Republicans 36 on health care. It's Democrats by 15, so they get that.
Okay, looking out for middle class families.
Yes,
Republicans only down by 3.
Yeah,
that's amazing. That's the working class shift you're seeing in this last election, right? You're seeing a lot of working class Americans coming over to the Republican side. You saw it with Latinos. You saw it with African Americans. You saw it with voting blocks that traditionally
unions
that traditionally don't vote. Republican right. are coming over. I was at the White House for one of the Christmas parties. It was great. They bring you in, you get to see all the decorations and all that sort of thing. And, you know, the head of the team, Sean, was there, the head of the Teamsters, a lot of the union heads were there. And I thought, well, this isn't typical. And God bless the president. He's calling them out saying, look, these guys typically might not vote all Republican and be with us all the time, but they know hard work that deserves credit.
That you're not against
bringing them.
See,
right.
For the longest time, you guys didn't care that a lot of your anti-union message was anti-blue collar. You're like, well, what can you do? We don't mean that. But no, now you went out of your way to say there's a difference.
That's right.
So it's so interesting. Back in a moment, I don't want to cut the second segment. Oh, by the way, are we only one segment, Allison? You were going to say we can continue? Because you were going to say if he wasn't good, just to get rid of him early. So he's okay?
Is my haircut good enough?
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he's in the private sector now. He's got it actually. Do you have a tailored blazer?
I do. I actually went
it's
to a tailor for the first time
amazing.
In my life. I
Did
went
you
to
even
a tailor
know what
for the
to
first
ask
time.
For when you walked into the dry
No,
cleaner?
My wife had to like write it out. She said, say this and then say this, but don't just walk into Macy's and get something. I mean, Macy's is great off the rack. It's wonderful. But I actually went to someone who pulled out that measuring thing and put it in places that you're not ready for.
It is
you know?
Amazing.
You're like,
though.
Whoa, you know,
I always thought it was amazing that you're asking baseball players to have two skills, use a mitt and a bat, but to have to work into a dry cleaner and say, clean my stuff. Now hem my pants.
Yeah.
Two totally different skills. We'll talk about that in a break. Back in a moment.
Illuminating. Intriguing. Inculcating.
I know some of these words.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news. Unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, I got some more time with Governor Sununu, who's got a new job and is demanding I use that title. He's currently the president and CEO of Airlines for America. I love America, like the plane. So this is a
great
job.
We love airlines. We love America.
So are you liking the private sector?
I love the private sector. I love the airline industry. I think
you were in
one.
You had your own business, right?
Yeah, you know, I was an engineer for a long time, and then I ran a ski resort through a bizarre series of events. Then I become governor. So to get out and not just into the private sector, but do it back in industry with CEOs you love, you respect. I mean, Robert Isom, who runs American Airlines, and Scott Kirby, who runs United, Ed Bastian, who runs Delta. You can go down the list. Just incredible individuals that know how to run. I love that. I love hanging out and being able to kind of glean off people like that.
All right. So I know you're more governor-based, but how about this in Washington? They're actually getting the appropriations bills done.
I know. Can you believe it? They better, because we only have 2 weeks or government's in a shutdown.
But this
again.
Is somewhat regular order. They're doing a minibus, but for the most part, they're one by one by one. They need 12, correct?
It's the most inefficient thing you've ever seen. All 12 of them need to pass to really avoid the government shutdown. The big one for us is the transportation. It's called THUD. If that passes, then we can pay our air traffic controllers, right? The one linchpin. It should pass in a week. But we're not there yet. Like, we're still panicked that something's going to fall apart come January 30th, all of a sudden. And we saw what happened in the last shutdown. 6 weeks later, Democrats are ready to throw Thanksgiving out the window, right? Until Hassan and Shaheen and some very, I think I would call them the wiser of the Democrat senators, got together and said, we can't let this happen. And they joined the Republicans and passed the bill and got government.
But a lot of people say Democrats were rewarded by the outcome of those off-year elections. Because of Virginia and Maryland and other things.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And look, could that mindset play into, well, let's stall them again in late January? It could. I think it's 70-30 that we get this thing passed. And therefore, again, as long as air traffic controllers are paid, the planes stay flying and everything stays smooth. There's no real political linchpin, if you will. That airlines are always the kicking boy for these shutdowns. So we got to avoid that.
The massive fraud that's being uncovered, now it's exposing in Maine, in California, and most of all in Minnesota yeah. Billions of dollars.
Yeah.
How was this able to happen year after year? And if you're a governor, how could you not know?
If you're a governor, you're an absentee governor, right? And I'm not saying that Governor Waltz knew or didn't know. I can tell you, let's face it, the guy was on the campaign trail for 18 months, completely ignored his state or whatever he was doing, and he was running around getting all this national attention.
But this
attention.
Fraud stuff was up
yeah,
in
it's
his
your
background.
Job to know.
It should have been Eric Holder should have said, hey, Kamala, 100%. You can't pick this guy.
100%. And now I will say this. I think especially if you go back during COVID, if you look at unemployment insurance fraud, the level of fraud to the tune of billions – you're barely scratching the surface with Minnesota. As governors, we used to talk about it all the time. I could tell you California, we exposed it big time. And I think, wasn't it Washington State that was giving hundreds of millions of dollars to folks in Africa at the time? They were paying people in prisons unemployment insurance. California,
only
billions of dollars.
Only through corruption.
Yeah,
right.
Billions of dollars of fraud in California, specifically on the unemployment side.
Doesn't this add significantly to the deficit? This is not small money.
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. You're paying for it. Every one of your listeners is paying for this stuff. So, some of us took it real serious. Some of us were, I think, clamped down hard. Others didn't, and they're paying the price. And hopefully, this sets something in motion that everyone is held accountable.
Am I right that New Hampshire has checks and balances where if Governor Sununu was hands off the wheel and there was corruption, there would be things reined in?
You'd know it in a second, and then we'd get reined in a second. Right. Other states just let it go.
And that's what's happening. Yeah. And that's part of the reason why I think they're kind of loving the ICE distraction.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's a whole nother one. But
I'm just getting you ready for CNN.
The most important part is the live free or die state does it right.
Thank
you,
Governor.
That's the takeaway.
Chris Sununu.
Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Does the defendant have any priors?
DUI? Assault?
No!
When you got back, something was different. It wasn't that you'd changed. You'd been replaced.
I bet you wonder, where's my tribe?
I just want to wake up in the morning and feel something.
You were willing to give your life for your country. Now maybe you can try living for it.
So Stephen Graham plays Calvin Cole and is also a writer, director, and star of Sheepdog. Matt Dallas is also here. He plays Daryl Sparks in movie Sheepdog. They came out over the weekend, and they're both kind enough to come into studio. Good to see you guys. You reminded me. You were on Fox and Friends, 10 years ago?
Yeah, 2013.
And it was about PTSD and war.
Yeah, it was about our veteran suicide epidemic, post-traumatic stress. And, we were only 2 years into the journey at that time. So I just want to take this opportunity to thank you guys. And you believed in us from the very, very beginning. So this is a very full circle moment for us to be 14 years to get this film to the screen.
So, Matt, you must have been 11 when you were on.
We were babies. Yeah, we were pretty.
So tell me about the premise of the movie.
Yeah, so Sheepdog follows a treatment-adverse combat veteran who's forced into treatment, and at that same time, his father-in-law is released from prison, and Calvin, our lead character, is sort of forced to put the pieces of his life back together and explore his journey through to healing and through post-traumatic stress into post-traumatic growth. And our film is really about the focus on post-traumatic
growth. Steve, how did you study for this? Did you look at a myriad of characters and different soldiers?
Yeah, so 2011, we went on a nationwide road trip and it took a lot of time to get veterans across the country to trust two guys who seemingly, were from Hollywood. And we were very lucky from the very first veteran that we met in McAllen, Texas, George Rice. You know, he really opened up to us and set us on that path. You know, over the years, I was able to volunteer at the Detroit VA Medical Center. Again, God bless them for trusting me. And I was able to role play with doctors, neuropsychologists, neurologists, trauma therapists. I was taken in by Gold Star families, who really, really wanted me to see what it was like to be in their shoes, and the mental health professionals across the country. And so we were just very fortunate. And the thing about Sheepdog to share with folks is that this is the first film that not only focuses on post-traumatic growth, but it's a film where we pick up 10 years after our veterans' last deployment. There's so much life that is lived in that time, and we just hadn't seen a film like that.
And Matt, we've had two wars at least, two big wars that we know of, but the other wars for the last 20 plus years.
Yeah, but for us, like, our focus is on the war at home, right? Because there's, you know, the men and women, they get sent across the, you know, to fight for us, but then they come home and, you know, the resources, there are so many resources in place, but unfortunately when they come home, they just don't utilize them. And that's why we're asking the VA to partner with us, because there are 5 million veterans that are not using the resources that are available to them.
Right. I want you to hear another clip of the movie. This is Vondi Curtis Hall. This is a clip from Sheepdog. Let's watch 36.
We came back and they spat on us at the airport. No homecoming parade, no celebrations.
I bet you wonder, where's my tribe? And I ain't talking about no friendship neither. I'm talking about brotherhood. My pain is relative, son. Sometimes we gotta fall apart to find ourselves all over again.
So, describe that.
Yeah, first off, that's Emmy nominee Vondi Curtis Hall, who grew up in the Vietnam era in Detroit. His lines, his dialogue were very well informed by all the honor flights I did. I had the good fortune to be a part of out of Austin, Texas, where you take Vietnam veterans and World War II veterans to the respective memorials in D.C. During that time, if you're lucky enough to be invited down to the hotel lobby bar after you've had a very sobering day at the memorials, there was so much shared. And his performance is nothing short of stunning in the film. You know, he had friends drafted that didn't come home. He had friends that came home during the Vietnam era with post-traumatic stress. And he currently has friends that are battling cancer from Agent Orange. And his performance is just, is such a beautiful and perfect way to honor the service and sacrifice of our veterans.
So when you guys are together, like, Matt, do you guys take notes? Like, when you're hearing these stories, you think, I got to remember that. But you don't want to be rude as if I stop being a friend and start being a writer.
Yeah, so when we set out on our first journey in 2011 across the country, you know, we showed up pretty naive. We would set up cameras, and we thought, you know, we were going to really document this
nothing,
trip.
Nothing, no script, but just an idea.
That's correct.
We had a blank map up on the wall that we were just like, sort of had ideas of where we were going to go in the country. But, you know, we really, like, it was about where we're going to be able to get people to open up to us. But it was really when those cameras came off that the real stories came out. And that's when we realized pretty quickly that this was, that's where the real stuff and research was going to happen. And this whole journey has been about really respecting, honoring those stories and those men and women that spoke to us.
Did you find that they were appreciative, that you cared enough to ask?
Yeah, it goes a long way. I mean, for anyone who's listening, I know for civilians, it takes a lot of courage sometimes to say thank you for your service to a service member. I think what we would like to change, have the paradigm shift, is to say, how are you doing? Or tell me a little bit about your military service. The idea with the film is to, yes, to share awareness and to inspire, but we're trying to connect our military community that, you know, is our 1% that defends the 99%. We don't want folks to feel alone in their experience, disconnected from their families or their communities, or to suffer in silence. And just to bring up again with what Matt was saying, we're really encouraging the VA. There's 5 million veterans currently not accessing care that they have earned. That's rightfully theirs. The VA is our first line of defense.
Have they been receptive to you? Because
yes, it's been unbelievable. Listen, if you're a veteran listening, they let me in. I got to see it, warts and all. What I saw, though, was ordinary men and women coming to work, not getting rich doing it, and trying to impact lives, saving lives. I remember standing in a cafeteria at the VA Medical Center, and a corpsman who had saved 52 of 54 lives overseas. He was haunted by the two he couldn't. And he pointed across the cafeteria at a trauma therapist, and he said, that lady right there saved my life. That's what we're talking about, and that's what we're talking about with Sheepdog.
Right. Sheepdog is now out. It's a brand new movie. Steve Graham and Matt Dallas been working on this, what, 13 years, 14
yeah,
years?
Yeah, this is, 14 years to the screen, and we never took our foot off the gas pedal. It's been a long, hard-fought battle, and again, you guys have been so supportive, and we're just so grateful.
And Steve, you started a push-up challenge, too?
Yeah. So, it was talking about the veteran suicide epidemic is very hard. A lot of folks don't want to talk about it. It's easier to look away. And we were just trying to find a way to bring it into the social discourse. And so we started pushing out 22 push-ups at recruitment centers and videotaping it. And it was a slow burn. And, a year and a half later, The Rock and Chris Pratt and David Beckham and folks are doing it. And the idea was to anyone could hashtag that, and all the different VSOs across the country that could and were willing to be a part of it could help raise money for veteran suicide prevention.
Wow. And what year was that?
2000. We started it in 2013 out of Dallas, Texas. And then I think it took off getting closer to 2015. But again, we were just right out there, kept making those videos.
Yeah. So guys, Matt, why don't you tell me, how do you go from writer to actor? In your head?
Well, I didn't write the film. Yeah, Steven wrote the film. But for him, it was about the determination to share these stories and to uncover the truth.
Were you with him for a lot of these stories to hear him firsthand?
Yes. We actually went on multiple cross-country road trips, like getting into every nook and cranny of the country.
Were you listening to these stories as an actor?
So that is exactly... So when Steven first approached me about this project, he said, I'm not exactly sure that it's going to be a film, but if it is, I think you should play my best friend. But you have to go on the road with me, and you have to sit and hear these stories firsthand so that you can look into the eyes and so you're truly immersed and what that experience is.
So some of the combat veterans reacted to Sheepdog. Is Bobby, Donald, and Lou. Let's listen to what they said. Cut 37.
All that pain that we carry was taken and turned into a piece of art. It was turned into a film to where the civilian population can understand what happens in the minds of veterans when they come home, especially combat veterans.
It's not like all the other war movies. It's not the cool guy shoot them up, it's not about that, man. It's about the real war that we face. And from a guy who was at senior level, we're not trained to face the civilian world.
Incredibly powerful. I had never seen any of these actors on the screen before. They all looked like they were portraying their characters for real. I didn't see actors. I just saw real life.
And by the way, that last guy was a board member at SAG-AFTRA, but that's probably the ultimate compliment, right? That's your audience.
Look, I get emotional listening to that, because that's all we wanted to do, is to make an impact and depict these folks authentically on screen, for having the courage to trust us with their stories. Across the country, we were on the film festival circuit, and having Vietnam veterans stand up in front of a full auditorium in tears and saying, you guys nailed it. Having OIF and OAF veterans, again, emotional at the end, standing up in front of a full theater, just saying, I wish I had this movie 10 years ago. I wish so my parents could know more about me.
10 seconds, Matt, your reaction to the reaction?
Yeah, I was same thing. I got very emotional doing it, but it was amazing. We just had, even recently a veteran that stood up in front of the theater at the end of his showing to say.
So go check out Sheepdog. Steve and Matt deserve your viewership. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much.
God bless.
The Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back, everyone. In a matter of moments, we're going to go simulcast on FBN, your favorite business channel, no doubt about it. I know Maria Bartiromo is in Davos right now, and she'll be interviewing the president, I think, tomorrow. Today she interviewed Scott Bessent out there, Davos, where the rich and famous go to talk to each other about things that rich and famous people think about the countries that they're from and the economies. And it's different with President Trump there. He's like, I'm going to be the most important person there. So let's listen.
It's quite a big sell-off. The time is now 10:51 Eastern. That means it's time for Brian Kilmeade. Here he is. All right, Brian, today marks 1 year since the start of Trump's second term. What rating would you give him?
Out of 10, I would give him 8.4.
okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's okay. I'm the I'm the American judge of the platform diving competition. That's what I usually rate. But I would say this. I mean, there's so much stuff that he's done. For the thing that I would say everyone can agree on, the volume of things he's tackling, the order in which he is doing it, the organization of which has been implemented, it almost as if he spent the last 4 years trying to make sure he makes the next 4 years, when he was out of office, as productive as possible. He went in as the least experienced president. He comes in as the most experienced president. And he had 4 years to think about his would is going to be 8 years. So you can't say that anybody has ever had the experience that he's had. So he comes back in and he's doing everything at once. Sealing the border is the biggest thing. The Venezuelan operation was flat out awesome. He made the world a better place by blowing up Iran's nuclear program that they were lying through their teeth about. And we know he brought the fighting in Gaza to a screeching halt in a very creative way. Venezuela, extremely creative. The same with Gaza. I know it's not a done deal, but man, the fighting stopped and the hostages are out. No one denies it. The relationships he's established economically with the Middle Eastern countries and his effective push, subtle push, not direct, subtle push of Iran, through Iran, through Venezuela, Panama Canal, it's still a process, pushing China back. Not only in our backyard, but around the globe. If he follows through with secondary sanctions on anybody buying oil from Russia, he'll have hit China on Iran. Eventually, I think we're going to get there. We have more sanctions on them. Venezuela, they're paying full price now if they're getting it at all. And then Russia is where they get their other discounted oil. That if all these things, including Greenland, is about countering China, a rival, dare I say, enemy.
Got it. Next one for you, Brian. House Speaker Mike Johnson, well, he addressed Britain's Parliament today. And guess what? He appeared to lecture them on free speech. Watch.
Today it takes our courage, clarity, and conviction to defend truth, just as our ancestors did. And it means being able to say that some things are true and good and enduring, and others are not. And to call evil and madness what it is. History teaches us we can never go down the road of censoring and silencing unpopular opinions because liberty is kept alive in the free marketplace of ideas. History further teaches us that the best solution to the problem of free speech is always more speech.
Brian, I think it's ironic that the Speaker of the House goes to the mother of all parliaments and lectures them on free speech because that's justified. Free speech is an issue in Britain.
Yeah, a little bit softer than J.D. Vance did, but basically the same message. He gave a very nice speech. It was fantastic, flawlessly delivered, eloquently as usual. But he did include this in because he says, guys, you can't arrest people for their tweets. You can't indict people because what's on Instagram, that's what you're doing. We understand that sometimes you can be inciting over this. And if you threaten someone's life, we're going to find out who you are and Secret Service is going to catch up with you. But you just can't ban people because you think that maybe there's something that's anti-Catholic or anti-Muslim. You can't put people in jail, and that's what they're doing. And the crackdown is not reminiscent or indicative of a democracy. So if anyone's going to hear it, it's going to be America telling them. And by the way, they have no problem calling us out when they see things that they don't like in the streets. So why not call them out? Because this is something that needs to be called out because it gives a voice to the people. But I also thought this is one speech that Stuart Varney got up at 4:30 in the morning to watch. Am I right, Stuart? Did you watch Speaker Johnson give this speech?
You are correct. I did watch, but I didn't get up for it. I've been up since 2:30 in the morning. Okay, like you, Brian. Okay. Just like you.
Yeah. All right.
Just like you.
I didn't expect that type of anger coming back at me, but I do say it is historic, acknowledging that 250 seems like a long time, but basically you guys have churches that are 2,000 years old. We're just getting started, and you talk about how 1 minute you're burning down the White House, the next minute we're shoulder to shoulder in Normandy. So
it's been a wild relationship, and I'm very happy to be here. Right. Kilmeade, you're all right, and we'll see you again soon.
All right, go get him, Stuart. Thanks so much. 1-866-408-7669. I do want to get to this. The national championship game was yesterday, and we had Indiana football. We had Indiana prevail on top with a fantastic game. As usual, I think they had with a better team. And believe it or not, even though it was in Miami, they were really the home team. Two-thirds of the stadium was pro-Indiana. I want you to hear the final touchdown that would be the winning score. Fernando Mendoza, guaranteed to go to the Raiders next year with the number one pick overall, cut 39.
He's going to take it!
So that was, you have to see this, this pinball move to get into the end zone, flat out phenomenal. Here he is after the game, cut 40.
All the glory and thanks to God. I was a two-star recruit coming out of high school. I got declined to walk on offer to the University of Miami. Full circle moment here playing in Miami. Thank you guys. God bless.
So did you hear what he said? He was a two-star recruit, five stars the best, two-star recruit coming out of high school. So he said, can I come onto Miami and walk on? You know what Miami said? No. So now he comes back and wins the national championships in Miami against Miami, where, and he's from Miami. So it is a full circle moment. And I think the stat, there's a stat, overwhelming stat, that basically almost every five-star recruit coming out of high school, quarterback, none of them made the pros. So they better hold on to that NIL money or the money that they get from going to these colleges. But I'll tell you, it's a great game, a lot of momentum, big ratings. But in the long term, I think college sports is in a lot of trouble. Listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show, BrianKilmeade.com. Find out how to see me February 14th in Fort Myers, Florida.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming to you from Midtown Manhattan, but heard around the country and around the world. So much happening today. We know I got up in the morning, time shifted, and to see Speaker Johnson doing something historic, speaking to Parliament in Britain about our 250th birthday, but looming over all of that, I'm sure you've heard, is the fact that not many people are happy with the president saying, I'm taking Greenland one way or another. There's threatening to blow up all of NATO. I don't think it's going to come to that. I think it's a negotiation. We'll discuss that. But meanwhile, we got some really good news. We have our own YouTube channel now. So you just go to YouTube at Brian Kilmeade Show, and you'll see this show in its entirety. You're going to get additional clips, and hopefully you subscribe to our channel. It's free. So before we get to our guest this hour, you're going to hear from the mayor of Dallas, Eric Johnson. And going to hear from Sage Steele talk about the big national championship game in football last night over in Miami, Hard Rock Stadium. But first, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
Less work with Denmark. The groups that benefit most from this break with NATO is Vladimir Putin. If we want to go against Russia, let's put some more assets in supporting the Ukrainians.
That is Senator Mark Warner, a constant critic of Trump, and I always expected more. Greenland's future on the forefront of President Trump's mind, and Europe convenes an emergency meeting. They're going to meet over in Davos. Perfect time for them to get together. I think the NATO secretary will make this happen. Mark Rutte.
Number two.
We're here to worship Jesus. Yes. That's why we're here. Yeah. Okay. That's why we're here. Okay. That's what we're about.
Don't you think Jesus would be understanding
we're about
these folks?
We're about spreading the love of Jesus.
Right. That's exactly it. Don Lemon telling us what Jesus would do. What kind of planet are we on? Raiding a church, taking over a Target store. Is that a peaceful protest? Is that love, like the mayor says in Minneapolis? That's the question all anti-ICERS have to ask themselves. As DHS announced they've arrested 10,000 illegals. You should be saying thank you, not getting in their way.
Number one.
Tomorrow is the first year. Think of it. 1 year. I don't think there's been a term like it. I don't think any president has had a better first year than we've had. But I inherited a mess, and now we have the hottest country anywhere in the world.
And the president's always selling, and he's right. Year one of term two is in the books. What has Trump accomplished, and what do you hope he still has left to do? Well, I'll tell you right off, he's got to solve Iran. Because there's nobody else that's going to come in and solve it. They're always going to look to talk. And I don't want one war. But we have to show Iran that getting a nuclear program, expediting and exporting terror is not going to work anymore. Creating havoc in the Middle East is not going to be tolerated anymore. Literally, we're down to one country. You know, I know Syria is imperfect, and I know these empires, the UAE and Qatar and Saudi Arabia, aren't perfect. They're not the democracies that may be outside visiting we want to live in. They're never going to be democracies, in my view. But so what? we can deal with them. They're thinking economics first. They're trying to make their people's lives better. So if you ask me what Trump's got to handle, he's got to handle the most unpopular government, not only in the world, in my view, but in their own country. They're hated. The Ayatollah's 86 can't die soon enough. But the next guy is most likely, and so it was supposed to be his son, but his son's evidently a real moron. But it'll probably be someone just as evil. The people deserve better, and I think Trump's moving assets in there to do just that. Hopefully continue on the path when it comes to Israel, Gaza phase two. But I also hope at home we have a chance to not only, I want to put into law everything the president's done at the border so no one can come in and screw it up again intentionally. You know, you see clips from what Bill Clinton used to say. He sounded like Donald Trump. You saw what Barack Obama exported all these people that came in here, threw them all out by the millions. And suddenly everything changed. So I hope to put that into play. Obviously, the tax system is a tax system and they're now permanent. That's great. I want to see another reconciliation bill. And I do want to do something, if we can get together with some sober-minded Democrats, voting reform. I don't care who wins. I just want the real winner to win. Same thing. That's why you have instant replay in football. You know what? You might be rooting for a certain team, but can we just make sure that the right call gives us the right winner and you have a chance? So let's not do the mail-in ballots and let's make voter ID mandatory. All the things that I think everybody can agree on, I hope. So those are the things I hope he accomplishes, as well as getting that ballroom done. Here's the President of the United States talking more about what he's most proud of, and that's the southern border, cut two.
Closed. You can't come in. Nobody comes. Nobody even tries. And the people in Texas, Arizona, all these places that are won by such big numbers, they are so happy with the border. They had homes that they weren't even able to live in their home. Every day people were knocking on their door every hour. And it's just a great honor to be involved with it. The ICE and Border Patrol and all of the people have been so good. Tom Holm and Kristi Noem.
So listen, I didn't think it was possible to do it. He didn't do it in his first term. He's trying to finish the wall. You know, they're building the wall right now, but it's almost insurance instead of being the focus. So it's just they couldn't get more than $1.2 billion to build the wall when I think $10 or $15 billion would have finished it. And they could have gotten it, but it couldn't happen. They were trying to stop the president from looking effective. They wanted to ruin him with the Russia hoax. So they basically held him up all other financing and didn't want to finance the wall because it would have looked like he's keeping a campaign promise. The other thing we're talking about is the border peace. What is the border peace? In the region, they want to have this convene of leaders around the region in the Middle East and that are invested in there, playing a role in the border peace. So when these skirmishes break up, there's a way to act to try to diffuse things on all sides. We see it nonstop. We saw it with Gaza. That's what happened between the Israelis and Hamas. That's what's happened in Pakistan and India. President's done it 8 separate times, but now they're putting this border peace together because it's not okay just to let Gaza get rebuilt, have the tunnels be refurbished, and go with do this whole thing again. I don't want that. I hope you don't either. But guess one thing that came clear is that Macron's not going to be a part of this. Here's the president hearing last night that Macron doesn't want any part of the border peace. Cut for it.
Have you invited President Putin to be a member of the Board of Peace?
Yeah, he's been invited.
Do you have any response to President Macron saying he will not join the Board of Peace?
Oh, did he say that? Well, yeah. Nobody wants him because he's going to be out of office very soon. So, you know, that's all right. What I'll do is if they feel like Costco, I'll put a 200% tariff on his wines and champagnes, and he'll join. But he doesn't have to join. If he said that, you're probably giving it to me a little bit differently. But if he actually did say that, but as you know, he's going to be out of office in a few months.
Did you invite President Putin to join the...
Yes, he's one of the people. These are world leaders, and the answer is yes.
By the way, there's no way President Putin belongs on the border peace. You know, if it was the President Putin in the 90s when we were trying to sway him, is he replace Yeltsin? But what I've seen, there's nothing about this guy that's peaceful. Remember, he kept Assad in power. bombing Chechnyas, just destroying them. Look, I'm not a big Chechnyan fan, but that looked like it was trumped up to make him look more powerful than he was. We know the invasion in Georgia. We know the penetration through the borders in NATO. We also know what he's now done in Ukraine, refusing to even get to the table and talk about a legitimate end to the fighting there. So there's no way he should be on the board of peace. I disagree with the president on that big time. But Turkey and others, I want them involved. Because I want them to put pressure on the groups that are involved. They can't just be people of like mind. I don't know why we need the $1 billion price tag. I don't know where that came from. But I just think that there's a lot of good things going on in the first term, in the first year of the first term, of the second term. And I just think it would be great if at least some of those other outlets would acknowledge it. And I'll bring you to the fact that the president's got 45% approval. You might think, wow, that's not good enough. It's actually surprising. Considering 96% of all the press on him, 92% is negative, considering the spin that they almost have on every story, even stuff that come out great, like Maduro ends up in a Brooklyn prison, I think that in this polarized society, you're never going to, I think it's going to be very rare for any president to get over 50% on anything. I think when it comes to immigration border, obviously the Republicans have an advantage. When it comes to the economy, Republicans have an advantage not big enough. If they can get this thing on track, it'll be substantial. I think the biggest joke is what James Carville said. He said, oh, there's no doubt about it. I know what's going to happen in the midterms. Cut seven.
I'm looking at the 2026 elections, and frankly, it's going to be a wipeout. Your viewers need to know that the Democrats are going to pick up at a minimum 25 seats, maybe as high as 45.
Wow.
In all likelihood, the Democrats will carry the Senate. So, and I think we're shaping up very well for the 2028 election, but I don't know, 2030 is, I'm 81, that might be on the other side of my horizon.
So that is James Carville weighing in. Look, to me, that's a hope. Remember he guaranteed Kamala Harris would win? People are running with that. I think it's all going to come down to the candidates and what the economy's doing, which brings me back full circle to Greenland. Mr. President, you can get the best deal possible now because everyone's scared to death. You get 2/3 of all the rare earth in Greenland, close, easy to mine, refine as everything melts away. Get NATO to invest and help us expand our presence, maybe put 6 more military bases there and start building what needed for the land-based Golden Dome operations. But we don't need to own it because then we're going to have to write a check for $900 billion and then be the social safety network for all Greenlanders. We got enough to do over here. So, and that's why hitting them with tariffs for not allowing us to take Denmark, that's not a positive either, because you worked so hard to get that EU deal done. Listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. When we come back, so much more. Don't move, including my interview with Sage Steele after last night's big IU win.
So busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back. You know, there's a rising star on the right and left. We all got him. We all know him. Some people think it's Shapiro on the left or Bashir. I understand it. I think on the right, there's a guy not many people are talking about that should, and that is Mayor Eric Johnson. He is the mayor of Dallas. He was a Democrat turned Republican, really effective mayor over in Dallas, and I wonder what he's going to do next. It's part of the reason we've been trying to book him on One Nation. And here's my interview with him, and he talks about really what's going on in New York City and how it's helping Dallas. Listen. My next guest declared his city to be a, get this, sanctuary city from socialisms like Mamdani. Joining us right now is the mayor of Dallas. He's the former Democrat turned Republican, and he's very conservative, and he wants to welcome big business to Dallas because it seems to be possibly not welcome in New York. Mr. Mayor, why are you okay? Why are you okay not being a sanctuary city? And what's your reaction to them doubling down in New York and other elsewhere?
Well, we support law enforcement here in Dallas. We support law and order. It's something I think is very important. I don't think you can have a city if you don't have safety. And so I don't understand the impulse that some of these Democrat mayors have to embrace lawlessness, frankly, and to be preaching, just to be blunt, not cooperating with any law enforcement agencies that are trying to help keep your residents safe. So to the extent that you want to define a sanctuary city as a city that is an open defiance or openly hostile to law enforcement, including ICE,
Yeah, it just doesn't seem like New York's going to budge. And the Mayor Eric Johnson's Dallas, you're not going to see what's happening in Minneapolis. I mean, what is your reaction to what's happening there? You have local law enforcement just not even arresting anyone, even though we see the destruction of FBI cars, the stealing of their guns, the stealing of the paperwork, the attack on officers. How did things get so bad? And what do you think about when you see this?
Well, look. Look, first and foremost, it's just it's a tragedy what's happening in Minnesota and Minneapolis. And we need to lower the temperature there. But how do we do that? And the answer is the rhetoric has to stop. The anti-law enforcement rhetoric just has to stop. Mm-hmm. And the second thing we have to do is we actually, we have to make sure that we are supporting law enforcement and the exercising of their duties and doing their job. And the folks are actually making it hard for them to actually engage right. in the law enforcement activities. And that's getting people hurt.
But what you do see is things, people and businesses moving to Dallas. In fact, in a Wall Street Journal editorial, you wrote what was already a trickle is going to turn into a flood of individuals and companies who have called New York home for a long time and moving to Dallas. So you guys are building your own mini Wall Street there. Do you believe it's only going to get bigger once people see who this mayor really is? And the fact is, he doesn't like capitalism. He doesn't think billionaires should exist.
Dallas was already moving in the direction of being a hub for financial services before the new mayor of New York was elected, and it's just going to accelerate now. It's already accelerating. I'm already getting the phone calls. We're already having more conversations than we've ever had before, and more interest in moving to Dallas by New York-based financial firms. Yeah, the answer is there is a flood and an avalanche of interest in being where I think people who do this for a living, folks in the financial services industry, understand that the future of capitalism in this country is moving west. And it appears to be that New York wants to be the heartbeat of socialism in the United States. And that appears to be the direction it's going. But down here in Dallas, I can tell you we embrace business. We embrace capitalism. We embrace corporations who employ folks and who are actually pillars of our communities.
In an editorial, when talking about politics, there's an op-ed I think might have got your attention as a former Democrat. David Plouffe, who got Obama elected twice, is urging Democrats to change course. Democrat, he writes, the headline is David Plouffe says Democrats will lose in 28 unless they change course right now. He writes the Democrat Party still is in a crisis despite their success in 2025 and needs to overhaul their broken brand and add a fresh slate of fresh agenda, fresh ideas to win races in hostile territory. You decided to switch parties because you didn't like the direction of the party. Do you think this party is ready to listen to David Plouffe?
I don't know if they're ready to listen or not, to be honest with you. I'm not really privy to those conversations anymore. I'm not really welcome at their gatherings anymore. But I will tell you this. David Plouffe is right. The reasons why I left the Democrat Party myself are the reasons that he's concerned that Democrats are going to have a hard time in 2028. Now, what they have going for them is that my party, the Republican Party, struggles a bit when Donald Trump himself isn't on the ballot, and he won't be on the ballot in 2028. But as far as the issues are concerned, Democrats are losing normal folks. Everyday folks are concerned about law and order. They're concerned about the economy. They're concerned about jobs. And Democrats are increasingly becoming, and really are at this point, if we're just going to be honest about it, an anti-law enforcement and an anti-capitalism party. They are pro-socialism, and they're for, frankly, lawlessness and disorder. And so I think everyday normal folks are going to continue to migrate away from the Democrat Party the way I did. And so I think David Plouffe is right. He's talking about the Democrats need to focus more on hiring police officers and first responders. He's right about that. He's talking about they need to focus on affordability. But if you think about what he actually said, how they should do it, it's what I've been saying for a long time myself and couldn't get any audience in the Democrat Party. But Republicans understand this. Focusing on the supply side of things when it comes to housing. We can't government build our way to affordability in housing. We can't rent control our way to affordability in housing, despite what the mayor of New York is saying. The way we lower prices in the housing market is to build more of it.
Yeah, I just, anybody who predicts exactly what's going to happen is really has, you know, they have no idea, because there's so many different variables taking place. And also, who's going to come to the issues, not only know the issues, but have solutions. Knowing think affordability is a problem is one thing. How you fix it is how you should vote, if that person answers your question correctly. Mr. Mayor, thanks so much. Great to see you.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
That makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. It's going to be a great half hour. We've got Sage Steele standing by. And we'll also have a look back at a couple of my interviews over the weekend that's getting a lot of traction. And that, of course, is I want people to see the big picture with the President of the United States. He's not winging it, looking at leaders he doesn't like, land he wants to acquire, picking up oil opportunities or gas opportunities, or trying to rein in allies. He's trying to counter one enemy slash rival, and that is China. And that is the big picture that I wanted to discuss on One Nation on Sunday. And I think more and more it's so clear to me this is all about countering China. But he's not doing it in confrontation style. He's doing it in a subtle strategic style. It makes it a lot easier to deal with China because they are so insecure. They always get their back up when challenged directly. And the president's learning that. Not that he's worried about a challenge, but if your objective is to neutralize, it's not in our best interest. So here's a look at my monologue and my perspective from Sunday and my follow-up with Senator Mark Wayne Mullen.
You know, for both fans and critics, no one can deny that this administration is one of action and constant motion. To me, I see progress. I see a game plan. But as critics, choose to see chaos.
CNN's Elena Treen is at the White House with more on this chaos, confusion.
This is about causing mass chaos.
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 He's unleashing chaos on the American people.
Donald Trump wants this chaos. He wants confusion.
Yeah, exactly. I see it differently. Maybe you do, too. I think it's calculated. And it's all focused on one thing, China. Now, it's not unusual for President Trump to talk about China as the number one threat to America.
China-centric. I wouldn't want it if I was China either.
Leading China by a lot.
China-centric.
And we're doing great against China.
We have a deal with China.
The people that are fighting me are people that want China to do well. And we're doing great against China.
Yes, but this time around, he's changing his approach. It is indirect, and it might be more effective. I know he hasn't mentioned them much lately, but the thing is, you don't have to say China to act against China. For example, Venezuela. 12,000 miles away from us. How does that impact them? Look at oil, for starters. China is Venezuela's largest buyer of crude oil, minerals, gold. Since Maduro's capture, the number of oil tankers departing Venezuela for China has plummeted and is no longer sold for bargain basement prices. A sycophant ally lost. Look at Panama. China's control of the canal being brought to a close, ending their ability to shut us off from either ocean at any time, minimizing their influence in our backyard. And speaking of our backyard, there's Cuba, known for providing China with a strategic foothold, cyber ears listening to America, 90 miles off our shore, while China, in turn, offers up crucial economic aid for all that access. Now, I don't know if you can hear the heavy breathing, but Cuba is on a respirator. When that plug is pulled, look for the backwards island to come under our influence. China out. South America isn't Trump's only strategic way to take on the superpower. Let's head up north. How about to Greenland? The bid to buy it may be more strategic than you think. The unprotected island has a path to the Arctic, rare earth minerals, and, drumroll please, oil. Trump isn't taking any chances. He's not looking for a deal. He's looking for a deal. He's not looking for an invasion. And he wants to make sure China doesn't get in there at all. In the Middle East. Yes, Iran is on the cusp of a revolution. But more importantly, they are a source to sell China deeply discounted oil. They are a nation who breaks world sanctions in exchange for Iran's natural resources. If they fall, yes, this Iranian government, China feels it in the solar plexus. Pay attention, world. He is not playing global cop. He is playing America first, which is always keeping our enemy slash rival front and center in his decisions. Just because we're not flooding the Pacific with our armada, naval armada, doesn't mean he's not about defending the Pacific Ocean. This is not chaos. It's called a well-constructed executed plan. I see it a major success so far. You know, there is one point of leverage that China has, and that is rare earth. But Trump is already working that out. Did you notice? He's calling together a meeting of all our allies, all hands on deck approach to mining and refining to give us all back control of our weapons, our phones, our grids, and electric cars. So while people think Trump's tactics can be chaotic, can be unorganized, in reality, it's really just the opposite. There is time to confront. There is a time to contain. And by going after our problems around the world, we're actually suddenly containing and confronting our number one challenge all at the same time. And you know who realizes that? China. He's not making it easy for them to retaliate by getting into a war of words over imposing tariffs. That happened 9 months ago. He's just trying to beat them everywhere and every place they look. Joining us now to expand on this, a guy part of that game plan, Oklahoma Senator, Senator Mark Wayne Mullen. Senator Mullen, you've heard people accuse the president of chaos. I see a plan. You know him personally when the cameras are away. Is there a plan?
Yes, absolutely, Brian. Look, what the president is doing here is for years we've been accused of playing checkers, why China's playing chess. The president has completely taken the chessboard off and says we're not even playing games anymore. And let's look back at what he first did. When he went in and he started redoing the tariffs and saying you're not taking advantage of us anymore, if you want to do business inside the United States, you're going to pay a price. If you're going to steal our jobs, you're going to pay a price. If you're going to try to undercut us, we're going to go after those countries and we're going to put sanctions on them. What that was a direct hit to the Belt and Road Initiative. And mind you, the Belt and Road Initiative that China had in place was to cause all roads to lead in and out of China, which is a huge economic threat to the United States and the rest of the world. And then you start seeing what he's doing right now with Venezuela. If Venezuela was just playing par, just being a good neighbor, we would be perfectly okay with it. The problem was is that Venezuela was a drug cartel, and a lot of the precursors for fentanyl was flowing through Venezuela. And then at the same time, Venezuela was selling 400,000 barrels of oil a day on the black market to China, which means that they were paying about 30 cents on the dollar less than what the real price is. And then you see what's happening in Iran right now. Now, that wasn't necessarily our direct influence there, but we are supporting the Iranian people to get their country back and get rid of the Ayatollah and the murderous regime there. But they were also selling oil to China at a 30% discount at 1.4 million barrels a day. So now there's 1.8 million barrels less.
Right.
Russia has got sanctions on them. They're not able to do it. With all that being said, if China's only got about 90 days of supply of this cheap oil, soon as the cheap oil leaves, they're going to have a 30% increase on production, because you cannot make a product or deliver a product without figuring in the cost of energy. So it's putting a huge strain, and President Trump has outflanked China every step of the way, Brian.
And I'm going to add something else. You guys voted on a bipartisan way, over 80 votes in the Senate, to put secondary sanctions on every nation that buys oil from Russia. If you put that into play, that will really slam China, Russia, Turkey, and Brazil.
And we could possibly be dealing with that the last week of this month, if not the second week of February.
Great. I want to talk about our allies, because I had a chance, as you know, to go over to Germany, meet with our fantastic men and women who are serving on a daily basis, and really impressed with their strategy. The other thing I'm impressed with is the loyalty from our allies. They are really motivated to strengthen NATO. I had a chance to talk to a German major general. Here's what he said that he discovered in being with Americans every day.
It's really amazing, especially when you're looking that they are luckily the only superpower which is able to project forces globally. And to see it here in the European theater, how they can make it, how they manage it, this is really amazing. Very clear, very focused on that we have to defend the territory of the alliance, and that we are close allies throughout the transatlantic partnership, which is that what I would say guarantees our freedom, our democracy, what we've had in the past decades.
And he goes on that the Germans have doubled their defense budget. All the Baltic nations have gone over the threshold necessary for NATO. Poland is putting together an arsenal, percentage of GDP higher than anybody else, including us. The NATO allies finally get it. Senator, your thoughts.
Well, when the president of the United States leads from the front and he emboldens peace through strength, it emboldens other people to follow, because there's always going to be a world power. As long as we've studied history, there's always been a world power. People want the United States because, unlike any other world power, we're not conquerors. We're there to support, to be able to bring peace and democracy around the world and allow people to have the freedom of choice, because we believe in that. That everybody has the right, given by God, of freedom if you choose to. So people were hungry for a leader, right. And President Trump came in at a perfect time to do so. Now, right. On a different note, Brian, we really need to talk about your deadlift. I saw that was your first time to ever do a deadlift.
Yeah.
Tell me how sore your back was.
Well, you know what? That's the thing. I've bent lower back, so they said stay away from it. The guys on the base said just the opposite. You have to do a deadlift. And it's better. And they were going, I said, all right, guys, this guy was my height, only 220 of solid muscle. I'll take his advice. Real quick on Greenland and our allies. We got Germans, the British, the Swedes. They're all putting like two dozen guys in there to keep us away. Would you like to see a deal done there? This seems to be built for a Donald Trump-style deal rather than ownership.
Well, let's talk about what they're really doing. They are trying to keep us away, but they're trying to keep us away by trying to strengthen the area, because NATO and the United States has been warning Denmark for 20 years that say, hey, you need to get Russia and China out of your backyard. They're mapping the seas. They're using it for an aggressive position, and they're starting to jam up the shipping lines. So what they're doing is they're saying, hey, look, guys, hey, United States, we've got it. But they're a little Johnny come lately. What the president has been saying about Greenland is, look, if NATO wants us to invest billions of the United States dollars to shore up that shipping lane, to shore up the NATO response for air defense, then we should have the ownership of that land, and we should allow the people of Greenland to make that decision. And by the way, we're okay with purchasing it if we need to, but we can't ask the United States to be the guard of the entire world and invest billions of dollars without it being on our own soil, because Greenland plays as important part to our east flank of the United States as Alaska does to our west flank.
And it was explained to me about the Golden Dome. We need it. And I think we'll get cooperation, because I
That's
think
right.
you scared the heck out of him. The president scared the heck out of him to this point. Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, always great. It's an exciting time. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, so that's my perspective. What's yours? Steve Mosher backed me up on Monday's show, too. He sees China as being totally countered, this being a big chess move. But when we come back, we talk about last night's big college football championship with Sage Steele. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Final score of the national title game in football, 27-21. I'm sure the ratings are through the roof. People love the Indiana story, from the losingest team in Division I football to the undefeated team. First one to go 16-0 since, I think, the 1890s or something. But because a lot of times they didn't play this many games back then, leather helmets, no face mask. But, you know, the Mendoza story, number one pick overall, comes out of nowhere to win it. That is fantastic. I also thought it was great to talk to Sage Steele today. And Sage is from Indiana. She's actually an ESPN anchor. Now she's got a really successful podcast. So I thought she'd be the perfect person to talk to about the game. She was there, about the president's presence. What was it like? And also about the controversy that happened the day before with the Miami quarterback. So we begin with Donald Trump, who went to the game talking about how great it was.
We saw a great game tonight. Congratulations to Indiana. It was really turned out to be a great game. Two great teams, wonderful teams with a lot of talent. We enjoyed it very much.
And by the way, if it wasn't a great game, he would have left, because he left the Super Bowl at halftime. Our next guest is a Hoosier alum and a mega fan. She's the host of the Sage Steele Show with a rich sports background. Sage, your thoughts from sportscaster and then sports fan. What does it feel like?
It was so nice to be able to be a fan and not have to be professional, because crying as a broadcaster would not have been a good thing. Brian, I'm still in shock, and the way the game ended, it was definitely the most stressful sporting experience I've had in my 53 years. It was amazing to sit back and look at the number of grown men and women in tears, because there was never, ever any hope for this in football at Indiana University. We got to give credit to the president of the university, Pam Whitten, a woman who came in 4 years ago and said, you know what? The way to make your university great, academics, is to have a great football program. The financial benefit to this school is going to be amazing. But it was just, it was so special. And by the way, home game for Miami, right? I mean, it was easily 65-35 red in that stadium. By the way, the hometown of Fernando Mendoza, indescribable. I've seen a lot of sports in my career and nothing like this.
Here is the quarterback, the Heisman Trophy winner, after the game.
All the glory and thanks to God. I was a two-star recruit coming out of high school. I got declined to walk on offer to the University of Miami. Full circle moment here playing in Miami. Thank you, guys. God bless.
So what he tell us what he said in the very beginning there.
You know, I don't think everybody realized this, and I don't think I realized this stat. We knew that he was like a two-star recruit coming out of high school. Nobody really wanted him. His hometown team, the Miami Hurricanes, wouldn't even accept him as a walk-on. So you talk about full circle coming back and getting it done in his hometown against the team that didn't want him. Mm-hmm. Just beautiful. And the way this young man leads, Brian, first thing out of his mouth every single time, he praises God. He's such a beautiful role model.
So Carson Beck in Miami had a wonderful run. Carson Beck shocked everybody a couple of days ago when asked this question and the answer. Listen.
Carson, I'm curious, did you have class yesterday? What has it been like being you as a student this week, particularly yesterday?
No class. I graduated 2 years ago, so obviously I've been working towards other degrees now that I've gotten to Miami, but these programs take a little longer than just a year to finish, so obviously I'm not enrolling again next semester.
Leaves after the game, 6 credits, already graduated. This has rocked a lot of people who aren't insiders on this.
Yeah. Listen, it is different. It's where we are in college football, college athletics today. And I don't necessarily love it. He's 23 years old. He's a sixth-year senior. Listen, it took me 5, not 6. But at the end of the day, he took advantage of his redshirt season when he came into college. And then he was affected by COVID. And those kids whose seasons were affected got one more year of eligibility. That is why he's a sixth-year senior. It is fair, even if based on today's rules, even if we don't like how it works. But 6 years, next. Please, like, get a job. Let's go. I'm kidding. Right. He'll be great in the NFL, but it's just a weird thing in college football. And yeah, he's making between $3 and $4 million a year in NIL money. So I guess this is a job.
Right. And Sage, the thing that people are shocked at is nothing. He didn't do anything wrong. But you only have to take 6 credits,
no,
not 12.
Not at all.
And you never hear people academically ineligible anymore, because the word student is really, you have to choose to be a student athlete these days and not just an athlete if you're an elite Division I player. Sage Steele, thanks so much. Congratulations on the Indiana win. It's good for you to be a fan again.
So nice. Thank you, Brian.
All right, some things to let you know about. We're really excited. This is a big week for us because we now have our own YouTube page. So it's at the Brian Kilmeade Show. You can go find that address. Go look it up. Also, History, Liberty, and Last. First time in 2026. We're going live on Fox Nation, but I want to see you in person in Fort Myers, Florida on the 14th. And then May 30th in Reno, Nevada. BrianKilmeade.com for more. And thanks so much for listening, everybody. And always keep it right here.